Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. I'm Dr. Susan Kolb, and I'm pleased to have as my guest today Dr. Duke Johnson, who's the author of The Optimal Health Revolution, How Inflammation is the Root Cause of the Biggest Killers, and How the Cutting-Edge Science of Nutrigenomics Can Transform Your Long-Term Health. Hello, Dr. Johnson. How are you today?
Great, Susan. Wonderful to be with you.
Great. Well, I think you're spot on with the inflammation theory. That's been the smoking gun behind the majority of chronic illness that seems to plague the more developed countries. I guess we'd like to talk a little bit about how you got involved in preventative medicine. And I understand you were an emergency room doctor before your career took you in a different direction. Would you like to talk a little bit about that and how you came to find out what you did about chronic disease?
Well, I sure would. I was trained in emergency medicine at UCLA School of Medicine, and I actually loved emergency medicine. And one day I had a gentleman who was 39 years of age I diagnosed a heart attack on. I thought, wow, that's incredible. I'll never see that again. And then but just a little while later, there was a female at 41 and another male at 38. And I thought, this is crazy. I shouldn't be seeing these people. And finally, I talk about in the book, there was one gentleman who came in who was 38 and full cardiac arrest. And he just had the sweetest wife and 10-year-old daughter. And the look of love in their eyes for him was just amazing. It was just overwhelming when I saw them and talked to them. And I went back into the emergency room and proceeded with the code and going through the code, and he didn't make it. And we had a great team, but he didn't make it. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life patching people together to hold them together for 12 hours, or having to go out and face families like this to tell them that their loved one had died prematurely from a disease they didn't have to get. So I switched over to preventive medicine 20 years ago, and I just am passionate about stopping these diseases.
Well, it certainly is very important now. Statistically, we've not done much to, curb the increase in both heart disease and cancer in the United States. And as you know, we've not done a lot to increase our cure rate with cancer, except with some specific cancers like childhood leukemias. So where does that leave us? I guess that leaves us with prevention, doesn't it?
You know, it really does. It really does. You know, I mean, there have been a little bit of improvement in heart disease, you know, from the 70s on, but, you know, that's going to worsen again because we've got a worldwide epidemic of type 2 diabetes, and the number one cause of death of diabetics is heart disease. So, you know, that's going to start going up again, and you're absolutely spot on. It's for us to keep being reactionary in what I call the ICD-9 code mentality of always looking at a disease, we need to get on the other end of medicine and say, you know what? What do we really need to do to prevent these diseases? And most docs don't have really a clue as to what is true prevention because they weren't trained that way. I didn't really have an understanding. Most docs would say, oh, true prevention is a Lipitor prescription and tell somebody to lose weight, you know?
Well, it's a start, I guess.
Well, exactly, but they're so excited about the statins, and in reality, it's a whole lifestyle. And you know, everyone has this gut feeling that, wow, there's something else I can do, and unfortunately, you know, they'll run to a fad diet or run to a guy's newsletter who says there's theories and plots and schemes and all that stuff and drives everyone away from established medicine, and that's crazy too. So I try to be a balance there.
Well, as you know, the healthcare reform is at the center of the national debate right now, and I want to remind our listeners that heart disease often, if you don't die of cardiac arrest, and of course that has a great cost to society, especially when the breadwinner goes out, if you don't die of it, you usually end up with a coronary artery bypass, and of course I spent my first few months in surgery helping with those, and they have a price tag of about $70,000 to $100,000, depending on how many bypasses you have. That's your insurance price. Your Medicare price is closer to $40,000. And the cancer treatment, I mean, can you guesstimate what an average cancer chemotherapy course costs or a total body bone marrow replacement costs? If you don't die, and again, if you're the breadwinner, that's got a tremendous cost to society. If you don't die, then you go through that treatment. So it seems to me that if we could just get a handle on cancer and heart disease, And then also, of course, diabetes, which you said, I want to talk a little bit later about why we're in this epidemic of diabetes. I think it's very interesting. But anyway, we would be able to solve the healthcare reform problems, I think. I mean, the costs would go way down.
Absolutely. I mean, in all honesty, I mean, you know, for governments to say, oh, well, you know, we'll take over the payments and everyone will have health insurance, I can tell you, even if the government takes over payment, our United States government won't be able to afford health care 5 years from now because these epidemics are rising so rapidly.
They are. I mean, that's what they're not talking about in Congress is how quickly, you know, the portion of the population that doesn't have cancer or heart disease often has chronic fatigue. I mean, chronic fatigue is you know, epidemic now.
Absolutely. And what's so interesting is that they're still looking reactionary, somehow as if the government taking over is going to make everything work perfectly and there's going to be unlimited amounts of money. It'll bankrupt America with the trend that we're going. And in reality, what we really honestly need to do is get to true preventive medicine, which involves a whole lifestyle change. And that's what I lay out real carefully. I mean, it's so obvious to see because I have a unique view because I have patients in 30 different countries around the world. I work with an international corporation. I travel extensively, so I've had to become a student of global health, and it's so obvious that whenever a country industrializes and especially westernizes, that's when chronic disease begins, and we can reverse that.
Right, we sure can. Well, let's talk a little bit about your 8 pillars of optimal health. Would you like to go through some of those?
You bet. And in fact, the way I describe that is that if someone wants to have true optimal health in their life, that they have to build on the foundation, there are 8 pillars that are necessary to have that structure in their life. And number one would be to reduce the risk factors of chronic disease. And it's funny, even a lot of physicians will refer to heart disease as if there's only one risk factor. It's cholesterol in their mind and you know, let's get the total cholesterol level down to, you know, rock bottom levels, and that's the cure. And that's really ridiculous perspective. You know, I mean, people weren't dying of heart disease 100 years ago and in many countries 50 years ago. So it's not just cholesterol. It's our total lifestyle. So the number one pillar is to reduce all of the risk factors of chronic disease. And I teach that there are 15 for heart disease and 16 for cancer. And in fact, I've got almost 900 scientific references in the book because, you know, what makes me different than any other fad guy out there? Well, I've supported it with science.
Right.
Number two is exercise, and I define that as just moving your body. You know, we don't have to have a leotard and be in a gym. I mean, actually just going up a flight of stairs every now and then makes a big difference.
Right.
And then good macronutrition. A lot of people are confused by what is a good diet because the fad diets have confused them with high fat and high protein and those are inflammatory and accelerate the disease. And
and
good micronutrition is pillar number four. You know, we really there is a role of supplementation to reduce inflammation, and there's a lot of confusion about supplementation, and I lay that out. Number five would be to have a good attitude and you know, a strong spiritual base, a committed faith, and a solid, and you know, having a positive attitude and staying away from depression. A lot of research on that. Number six would be getting adequate sleep. Sleep deprivation leads to shortened lifespan and increased inflammation.
Sure
a lot of
does.
People don't know that. And
number
seven is good medical care. You know, it's so funny because a lot of the faddish people say, oh, everything in medicine's a plot, and you got to stay away from your doctor, and they've got the cures to all these diseases. No, the docs are trying as hard as they can, and I feel sorry for most docs because they're caught in that government regulations, but at this you know, of just trying to meet minimum guidelines. But at the same time, though, you know, there's some risk factors you can only find by being in a doc, and then finally, good air, clean air, and water, and good hygiene. You're not going to be optimally healthy if you've got bad water or you're exposing yourself to infected body fluids.
Right. Well, that's true. Also, under rest, I think it's important for patients to understand, I mean, listeners to understand, and patients too, that if it takes a certain amount of hours of sleep at a certain level before your body starts making adequate levels of growth hormone. And growth hormone is extremely important for the feeling of well-being, as well as muscle mass and you know, the anti-aging benefits that growth hormone has. And injecting growth hormone is not a great idea because you really need it regulated at a much more careful level, or you may actually increase risk of certain lymphomas, colon cancer, and so of course carpal tunnel syndrome and other things like that. But you know, that alone is scientific evidence that sleep is extremely important if you want to look and feel your best.
Well, absolutely, and I'm totally in agreement with you with the hormones like that. There's a lot of faddish people that'll take one piece of information, mm-hmm. you know, about the benefits of growth hormone and say, well, then therefore we should inject it in everyone.
It.
It's like, oh my God, you know.
Ooh,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I can almost tell how long someone has been involved in preventive medicine or looking at alternatives because of the progressions they go through. They jump onto foolish things like that. But leptin and ghrelin are you know, two other examples mm-hmm. that, you know, those hormones are definitely impacted by the amount of sleep. And leptin helps us to feel satisfied, and ghrelin gives you an appetite. And so, mm-hmm. you know, those levels rise when we don't get adequate amounts of sleep. That's why we wake up hungry. And if we have adequate sleep, we don't wake up as hungry. So those affect our obesity epidemics, everything.
And I take care of I'm a plastic surgeon. I take care of a large number of women with mold in or around their breast implants. And also I got referred a lot of patients who have mold in their house. Of course, mold in the house means you breathe in mold, which means you can get it on your implants. But essentially, the mold biotoxin knocks the leptin receptor off the hypothalamus, and so you get an endocrine disruption. And I actually, I was at Hopkins, they were grooming me to be an endocrinologist at Hopkins, and I ended up learning a lot of endocrinology, but I just wanted to say that the endocrine system is so complex that you can't just throw hormones in there. There's receptor levels, there's all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's kind of like throwing a horseshoe into a motor and expecting, you know, expecting the result to be good.
Exactly.
You really have to be careful.
I mean, oh, absolutely.
Because it's a delicately balanced system. I mean, look at how sick people get with sick building syndrome.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why, too, see, when everyone has that attitude that let's race to a medicine. A medicine is the panacea. It's perfection. And you know, those of us who have been practicing, you know, understand those risks and side effects. And mm-hmm. a lot of times, I'm not one of those docs who says, well, let's throw out all medicines by any means. But at the same time, you know, chances are the average person doesn't need 12 medicines on a regular basis.
Might be detrimental to their health.
Exactly. It's like, come on, let's hit a balance here. Let's get people on what they need, but then let's try to do it naturally if we can.
Yeah. I remember when we were residents, a few times patients came in deathly ill. We didn't know what was wrong with them, but they were on about 20 medicines, so we decided to stop everything, and they got a lot better. It's funny. You know, the emergency admission, like, gee, why is this person in a coma?
Well, and I love sitting in front of the TV with my kids, and they'll advertise, you know, a pharmaceutical company will advertise their medicine, and mm-hmm. you know, it's for rashes or something. They'll say, oh, well, and by the way, the risks include, you know, cancer and heart attack, stroke, and it's holy mackerel, you're
thinking about
for a rash?
I'd rather have a rash. The one I really like is the restless leg syndrome one. I think it's Miralax. And at the end it says, by the way, this can cause something about excessive gambling and something about sexual behavior. And I'm going, I'd rather have restless leg.
Yeah,
I mean, you wake up, you don't have restless leg, but you wake up pregnant with a venereal disease and all your money gone.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what happened?
Actually, you know, restless leg syndrome, a lot of problems that traditional medicine isn't addressing are actually, a lot of them are due to magnesium and electrolyte disorders. You know, if you could just get your electrolytes straightened out, that really is helping a lot of people.
Well, you know, what's so interesting is that, you know, established medicine has looked at supplementation as if it's like this big evil, and it just cracks me up because, you know, most people don't know, everyone in the world, and literally, I mean, I just was recently speaking in Italy and Germany and Malaysia and Singapore, and next month I go to Turkey. I travel a lot around the world, and everyone around the world has heard the statement, if you just eat a well-balanced diet, you don't need to supplement. But then I'll say, okay, does anyone know where that comes from? And nobody knows where that statement comes from. And I said, well, mm-hmm. it comes from the RDA. and they'll, or DRI, you know, today, but mm-hmm. the RDA, and they'll, and then the next question is, well, where did that come from? And nobody knows where that came from.
Right.
But it was designed to prevent deficiency diseases, not chronic
right,
diseases.
Right, right, that's true. And you can now, you can now measure intracellular levels of nutrients. I did a SpectraCell test, and even though I was on 2,000 units a day of vitamin D, I was still deficient in vitamin D intracellularly.
Well, it is interesting, and the thing that's in fact, I have a study that I've been sharing with people recently where they took some adults and gave them supplements and mm-hmm. a multivitamin, and despite being on a multivitamin, 20% of people were still deficient in about 5 to 7 different basic nutrients. In other words, mm-hmm. in other words, we're not even coming close to levels that are truly protective against the risk of chronic disease. And somehow the whole notion that all we have to do is be protected from a deficiency disease and everything else is a waste is crazy. You know, that's like saying all you need is enough money to keep from starving to death, but anything beyond that is excess.
That's right. That's very true. And, you know, it can be deadly. My mother was never diagnosed properly. She developed pernicious anemia later in life and was misdiagnosed as carpal tunnel when actually she had a peripheral neuropathy. Ended up with open heart surgery. Her cardiac surgeon called me and told me her heart was extremely sick and he didn't quite know why. And then that was when she was 75. And last year when she was 87, she had another cardiac cath because she was having some arrhythmias. And the cardiologist said, well, your heart's totally normal. Ejection fraction is totally normal. There's absolutely no evidence of coronary artery disease. And I'm not sure why they did all those bypasses. And all I did was put her on coenzyme Q10 and B active, which is a sublingual B12.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, that's very simple. And then she takes a multivite with some folate in it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have B12 and folate, that will help prevent the high homocysteine, which could have killed her at 75. And she had a normal EKG with that. That's very scary for us surgeons, you know. We have a normal EKG, and yet the heart is extremely sick. You know, you put that patient on the table for a facelift, and guess what you got?
Well, you bet. And a resting EKG doesn't really
give the
indication of what's going on under stress by any means, exactly.
So that sort of shows you that just simple replacement of, you know, just a few very important nutrients and vitamins and even minerals can really make a big difference in how someone does.
Well, and what we also need to do, too, is understand that whole concept, though, of inflammation, because it's so
mm-hmm.
interesting. One of my epiphanies was, in essence, a graph that I got that I put into the book talking about how the major causes of death from the Ministry of Health in Japan were infectious diseases prior to World War II, and then
mm-hmm.
immediately when they took on our westernized lifestyle, heart disease and cancer go up immediately.
Right.
And
right.
I thought, well, that's maybe just a coincidence, but I have the exact same graph for Korea. Right after the Korean War, the same
mm-hmm.
thing happened. And the same thing happened in China, in essence, but that started in the 1990s. So it's been the same progression.
Right.
It just depends on when they take on our westernized lifestyle, and inflammation's behind all of that.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about processed foods. You talk about the role of sugar. And I just wonder about also the role of plastics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have just recently uncovered this massive vitamin D deficiency, even in people who virtually live in the sun. That's what's so amazing to me. I have
right.
patients who get sunlight every day without sunblock or quite tan, and yet they still have a vitamin D deficiency. What's going on with that? Do you think the plastics are somehow involved in that?
Well, you know, first of all, there aren't very many food sources of vitamin D, and so you know, a lot of people, one of the food sources is milk, and people have gotten away from that exactly,
yeah.
and so a lot of people have been scared away from the notion of vitamin D, and so they're also getting vitamin D in tablets, multivitamins that are at levels that are trying to prevent rickets.
Right.
And so they're scared of the sun and they put on suntan lotion. But you know, it's really interesting. I don't know if there's ozone changes or if a lot of that research in the past talking about that conversion isn't as great or as strong as they said that it was, or if since that time we've had environmental changes. But boy, you know, there it is. About 95 to 97% of the people that I see, and I have a global clientele, mm-hmm. whatever place they come in from the world, about 95 to 97% of them have inadequate levels of vitamin D for sure.
And that's scary when we're looking at a worldwide flu pandemic, because vitamin D is a known, decreases your risk of at least, spreading the flu.
Oh yeah, and it does so many things. It reduces insulin resistance, and we've got a worldwide epidemic of type 2 diabetes.
Bad, yeah.
It reduces the risk of heart disease. It turns off the MS gene.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it cures MS, but it turns off the gene. That's been shown.
Right.
It does so many things, and then people will go to their doctor, ask about it, and then they get the knee-jerk response of, well, if you just eat a well-balanced diet. I mean, it doesn't want to scream.
Yeah, oh, boy. That's true.
And most even professionals have no idea. If you went to any professional in the world and said, okay, how much chromium have you had today?
Mm.
I mean, there'd be silence. They have no idea how much they've... most of us have no idea. We're relying upon... something that people have told us, and there's a lot of studies to show that in essence there's so much interaction with food interacting with other food, and the nutrigenomics of how food interacts at the gene level.
Yeah,
that we really don't know what we need. So, some of the science was still based on World War II science. It's 50 years old on what we're needed to take in. Which is crazy.
And I'm in the process of learning about functional medicine. I get a lot of, because they're free from my Medicare patients, I get a lot of NutriVals on them. And there's all these pathways, the pathways for the Krebs cycle and the essential fatty acids. And there's patterns that flow through this report that really do pinpoint the main problem. And it's different in different people, of course, but there are genetic variations. One person may require a lot more of one supplement or a lot more of one antioxidant because of pathway issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be genetic, it could be, I don't know, there might be other reasons too, but essentially we do have person-to-person variability in how much nutrients we need. And NutriVal comes up with, the usual recommendations, and then the recommendation for your patient, and say the usual recommendation of one thing is 40, but your patient is 400. Well, that means somewhere in the absorption or in the pathway or somewhere, or maybe they're on a drug that destroys that vitamin. You don't know. There's a lot of different, we're very, very complex is what it comes down to.
Well, it is, and I think the underlying basis, and see, that's one of the things that another epiphany I had in 2004 was that I taught for years that there are 15 risk factors for heart disease and 16 for cancer, and I knew that inflammation was associated with elevated cholesterol and smoking, and I thought, well, I wonder if I can find research to show that all of the risk factors I've taught for, 15 years, if I can find that there is research to show that these risk factors are actually overstimulating our immune system in a false way and actually being destructive, and found that to be true. And that was like, once we realized that every single lifestyle quality and characteristic that's part and partial of our normal lifestyle today and westernized lifestyle actually increases this inflammation, that if what we can do is just say, hey, what is it that I can do to take some steps to reduce this inflammation? Then what we can do is be very protective and reduce that chronic damage that's going on, for sure. Our lifestyles are huge in this issue.
Well, one easy way with the diet is eating more curry.
Mm-hmm.
Curry and pineapple with bromelain in it and, the turmeric in the spice family. All
Absolutely.
Of that is very, very good for anti-inflammatory. And then if you don't want to do that, you can take an aspirin a day, or baby aspirin, or every couple of days. You don't really have to take it even every day.
Omega-3 is low.
Omega-3s are very good,
anti-inflammatory.
Yeah.
And I
eating
list,
fish.
and green tea, and there
Olive
are multiple...
Oil.
Exactly. There are multiple, fruits and vegetables are loaded with anti-inflammatories,
right.
and I list those
are.
In the book. I have a whole chapter on the supplementation issue of it. But what a lot of people know is you'll hear the statement that, well, in order to be healthy, we have to go to the East in order to learn. But, you know, I have patients in China and I have patients in India. And, you know, most people don't know that the World Health Organization states that, you know, if current trends continue, there'll be more people dying of heart attacks in India next year than the rest of the world combined. And one in five type 2 diabetics lives in India today. But what they do do right is that their cancer levels are really low from the curry you mentioned in the curry.
Right. That helps. And the and the number one cause of death in China is still stroke, you know.
Yeah.
That's not going to change.
Oh no.
You know, unless they do some lifestyle changes.
Oh, absolutely. I have quotes from the Minister of Health of China where their obesity, their heart disease, their cancer is rising far more rapidly than it ever did in the West.
Their lung disease is going to go up from the air pollution, from what I hear.
Oh, geez. Oh, yeah.
You know, they got to control that because that's very, I mean, lung problems kill you very quickly.
No, in fact, I've had the opportunity to travel to 9 cities in China. And
what do you think?
Absolutely. At the end of the tour, one of my companions said, "Did you notice that we didn't see the sun unless we were outside the major cities?" And it was true. The only
that's
time we
incredible.
Saw the sun, and I was over there for the Olympics last year, and I have a picture. And it was in the middle of the day. It was a cloudless day, and you could barely see the sun. I took a picture of it. It was just the smog. Even though they'd gone through all of those measures to not have people work or drive for a couple
of
months,
it didn't matter. Well, they've got a real problem with that. I mean, they are industrializing at a rate much faster than I guess the U.S. did.
Oh yeah,
and controlling the pollution and not controlling the chemical exposure to them, and that'll increase the cancer rate. You know, if they increase chemical exposure.
In fact, some cities have 150 times the cancer rate of the rest of the country because they're just absolutely pouring unadulterated, untreated chemicals
into the
rivers,
ground.
and the rivers are like foamy. You know.
Oh God.
Oh, exactly.
You know, please learn from our mistakes. Don't repeat history again.
Especially. Exactly. We've already made plenty of mistakes.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, lately the Chinese have reversed their one family, one child rule.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Because of the increased death rate and also, especially, you know, dying of respiratory problems. A lot of young people die of respiratory problems. If you're a little compromised with cystic fibrosis or something like that, live in the city, you're in trouble.
Oh, absolutely.
And you know, they may be reversing it because of some statistics that we haven't seen, but death statistics that don't project you know, the population staying at an even level.
Oh no, it's horrible, and that's why I'm so passionate about this. That once I understood that it's the you know, that all of these, you know, inflammatory cheap oils that we take in our packaged foods and our fast foods, when they increase our immune system, you know, just like you were talking about the hormonal system, the endocrine system earlier, that it's very complex and it's beautifully
well-balanced.
It's unbelievable, yeah. Well, our immune system is the same way.
It was
designed to kill germs and bacteria, but when we take in these false chemicals, it's almost like kicking the immune system, where the immune system says, "Wait a minute, there's something in here I don't recognize," and it ticks me off, and I want to kill it, but I don't know how to kill it. So it goes around destroying the own body, and that's where the inflammation is destructive, and we don't understand many of this. And then a lot of fads will come out and say, "Oh, well, then take in this high fat, high protein diet, which increases inflammation," and that's what drove me to write the book. I just couldn't take it anymore.
Well, I learned something interesting about Raynaud syndrome. You know, just about every single patient with silicone toxicity has Raynaud's. And I had a patient come in who was working with a chemical called methylethyl ketone without gloves for about a year. And he had his bone showing in several of his fingers because the flesh had melted away. So in the process of taking care of him and researching this, I found out that Raynaud's disease is due to an arginine deficiency that is due to the chemical in the ketone family. So all of the women out there who are using acetone to take off their nail polish, be careful. And one of the most prominent chemicals on the chemical list at the Dow Corning trials was methylethyl ketone. So when these implants start to get, they have a lipolysis reaction, they start to leak in 8 to 15 years, the women get an internal release of these methylethyl ketone, and they develop Raynaud's. Well, if I treat them with arginine, pretty high doses, guess what happens? The Raynaud's goes away.
Wow.
Isn't that neat? Nobody else knows that.
It's beautiful.
I discovered that, but just, you know, putting different clinical things together.
And that's awesome, because what it shows is that, in essence, there are benefits, you know, to the chemicals that have been introduced to our society. But what I'd heard is that I forget the number, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of like 50 chemicals are cleared a week or something. There's no way in the planet, and with plastics, et cetera, there's no way in the planet that the government has a chance or time to thoroughly investigate each chemical that we're exposed to. So to find out what those benefits are, I mean, medicines are controlled unbelievably, and you have to go through like a 7 or 10 year. But then a soft drink company can say, hey, can I put this artificial sweetener in here, and there's hardly been any treatment or testing done on it.
Testing in rats.
Exactly, and there's one I list in the book where its cousin was outlawed because, in essence, it's been shown to increase cancer.
Right.
But they took one that was completely unstudied and said, "Can we put it in soft drinks?" And the government goes, "Oh yes, go ahead."
Go ahead. That's because the company wanting to do it, or the company that made the sweetener, actually was contributing to the political campaigns of a lot of important people.
Absolutely, money talks. No,
right,
you know,
right.
To think that our government would be a perfect overwatch and a perfect a shadow and protection to us in healthcare is you're living a fantasy world.
Yeah, you just don't understand human nature.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, can I ask you a little bit about what your opinion is about the plastics? This has come into the news lately. You know, when I was, I'm going to be 55, so when I was growing up, we had the glass baby bottles. But now, there's plastic in everything, and the kids go to school with plastic liners in their juices, and they suck on plastic silicone pacifiers. I mean, what do you think's going on with this?
Absolutely, there's no doubt about it. And it's so funny. A lot of the plastics will have that little tiny symbol on there that says "Don't use in a microwave."
Yeah, right.
Yeah, or a dishwasher. Yeah. And you know, here I'm thinking, oh well, they're worried about it melting, so I would stick. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, well, let's just put it into the microwave and see what happens. Oh, it didn't melt. I'm going to keep sticking it in the microwave. Well, what we don't realize is that a lot of these chemicals are leaching into the food. That's
right,
why it's not supposed to be there. And that leaching, there have been many of them that have been proven to be associated with cancers, et cetera. And it's critical to know exactly which plastics are safe and don't have that occur. That little symbol on the bottom that says number one is a safe one for sure, but there are several that are dangerous per se.
Yeah, that's true. I was talking with a founder of Penta Water about this particular problem, and he had done a huge amount of research, because, of course, they wanted to know what kind of bottling to use for Penta. And he basically said to look at the number and then also to avoid blue plastics, which was interesting. I'm not sure what's in the blue, but he says avoid those. So that's, I mean, for what that's worth.
Absolutely, and definitely numbers to avoid are 7 and 6 and 3.
Right.
I mean, all of that stuff should be thrown out, and food should only be stored or prepared in glass or porcelain or stainless steel.
Corn is good.
Yeah, exactly. And then the peat is been shown that's the one that's number one, and that's been shown to be safer for sure.
Yeah, that's what Penta's in. But, you know, he said glass is a problem because even some glass bottles contain lead. So just because it's in glass doesn't mean it doesn't have lead.
Yeah. Crystal is certainly going to have some lead in it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've got all these different, different things to pay attention to.
And that's why it really isn't just a quick fix. I mean, and that's why there have been so much false information, and that's why I wanted so carefully to lay out, and that's why, in essence, I'm proud to be what I call a fad buster. I'm not a fad type of a person. It's like, you know, and someone would say, well, what do you think of this? And I'd say, well, show me the science. If the science is good, I don't care how popular it is. Let's base it on the science, per se. And because there's a lot of faddish things that, you know, are you know, absolutely, you know, destructive. And we need to come back and say, okay, listen, let's throw out everything. Let's get away from the snake oil salesman. Let's just get out and say, okay, what do we know is solid and move from here? And that's where I try to be a balance between the East and the West. I try to be a balance between and just say, let's just move based on science. And I haven't had to go back on anything I've taught in 20 years. So it's a balanced approach to protect your listeners for sure.
Well, that's great. Would you like to give your contact information, including your website, for our listeners?
Yeah, the book is available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com, of course, but my website is Dr. Duke Johnson, D-R-D-U-K-E, Johnson, all one word, .com, and there's more information about the book and things that I've written, other interviews, et cetera. So hopefully your listeners would learn more from that as well.
All righty. One thing I wanted to mention is the kind of the epidemic of insulin resistance and obesity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's one thing or multiple things that are, I guess my question is, when do you think this started? What decade? And
the obesity epidemic or type 2 diabetes?
Well, I think they're linked, don't you?
I do. They definitely are linked to some degree, but not always, but I agree, yeah. Okay.
Okay. It's just that, you know, when I was in school, we didn't have 8-year-olds needing bras.
Exactly.
And we didn't have, you know, a large amount of overweight children. I mean, there was like maybe one overweight child in the class.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been, I mean, people have said it's more sedentary lifestyle, high fructose corn syrup, you know, there's many different theories, but I just wonder what the role of plastics is in this, if there's a role for plastics
it's really interesting. Once I started understanding that you know, inflammation, and let me get back to that, because it is so mm-hmm. critical. That once you understand that inflammation comes with industrialization, and what I mean by inflammation is chronic excessive, where our immune systems are overly stimulated, then when you start walking down that pathway, it's a very consistent pathway. And what I mean by that is, for example, adiponectin, controls normal fat metabolism. And I list a study in the book where adiponectin levels, they took individuals who had normal adiponectin levels and then put them into an inflammatory state.
Mm-hmm.
And these were normal weight individuals, and the adiponectin levels went down, and these individuals began gaining weight. So in other words, yes, there's some truth to all of those issues where people would say, you know, are we sitting in front of the TV? Are we less sedentary? Mm-hmm. Of course. But there's also mechanical things going on, that we have so many cheap oils in all of our foods that are inflammatory, that in essence, you know, some of the fad diets that are recommending high protein and high fat, they're also giving people high inflammation and messing up metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
That's why diets in the long run don't work, and we need to get away from that. So now there's a molecule, I don't know if you're familiar with, called CXC ligand 5, which was shown recently in Cell Metabolism article, that they took heavy individuals. Now there are scores of inflammatory molecules, and this mm-hmm. is just one of them. They took heavy individuals when you're talking about diabetes, type 2 diabetes and obesity being linked, and they definitely are for many people, but they took a group of individuals that were overweight and looked at their inflammatory molecules and tried to determine which of these individuals get type 2 diabetes and which obese individuals don't, because not everyone does.
Right.
And those individuals who had high levels of CXC ligand 5 were the ones who developed type 2 diabetes. And so then they started doing some work on the receptors and binding those receptor sites, and found that even if individuals had higher levels, if they could bind the receptor sites, they didn't get type 2 diabetes. Hmm. So what I really think is going on is a couple of things. And what many listeners don't know is, and I actually had an endocrinologist in Southern California that I used to refer to, who actually was doing some research with Reeven at Stanford, who's, you know, Mr. Syndrome X and Mr. Right. Insulin Resistance and the World Authority. And he said what we assumed for years was that type 2 diabetes was type 1. It just occurred, you know, several decades later. And so many doctors treated type 2 diabetes just like they were treating type 1. And mistakenly.
Right,
and he said, what we did is we assumed that their insulin levels must be low, because insulin is what is putting sugar from the bloodstream into the cell. It must be low because people are getting diabetes, and we never checked their insulin levels because it was expensive. He said, finally, one day we did, and to our surprise, their insulin levels were very high.
Right.
The problem was not with the body's ability to make insulin, the problem is the receptors are all messed up. And
right.
So what I've been able to take obese people, we have a group of 50 people we've brought through in the last, a total of 50 in 5 years,
mm-hmm.
who are almost all of them who are obese, who almost every single one of them had metabolic syndrome. Certainly every single one of them had extreme insulin resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was, by reducing, I have 17 steps on the chapter on type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, and we put them through those steps, and we studied them in January, and in April we restudied them again and checked their insulin levels, etc. Every single one of them were out of metabolic syndrome in just 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And none of them, except for one individual, 49 out of 50 had absolutely no insulin resistance,
uh-huh.
and the one remaining individual had about 10% insulin resistance, and that was just uh-huh. in 3 months. So now, once somebody becomes type 2 diabetic, I rarely can pull them out of it. But if they've been told they're borderline, et cetera, if they uh-huh. follow the guidelines in the book, we definitely can reverse that. I mean, because I think what's going on with those receptors is that by the what most people don't know is that we change over our muscle cells and most of the cells of our body, except for nervous system, heart, and kidneys, based on our diet. So if we take in bad oils, partially hydrogenated oils, etc.,
mm-hmm.
that's what's messing up those receptors.
Mm-hmm.
If we replace, again, good food and good nutrients and good components, the receptors start working again.
Right. That's important.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I'm just passionate about that, because that is a worldwide epidemic, and most people have absolutely no clue. And it's very simple to be able to reverse those trends, and we've proven it very carefully with about 50 people.
Let's talk a little bit about. We just have a few more minutes remaining, about 8 minutes or so. Let's talk a little bit about the Mediterranean diet, because that's something people can kind of grasp onto. Why is the Mediterranean diet going to be a good diet for prevention of heart disease and cancer?
You know, what's interesting is the true definition of a Mediterranean diet is kind of funny. It changes based on the researcher, and there's not a global definition.
Well, what is
because if your country touches the Mediterranean, that doesn't mean you eat a Mediterranean diet. And it's so funny, because I've got a lot of customers. Like I just said, I came back from Italy, and a lot of Italians eat just like Americans do.
Pasta.
So. but probably I think the best description really comes from probably one of the world's experts in omega-3,
mm-hmm.
who I have the privilege to know, Artemis Samopoulos, who used to be at NIH for 20 years, and she wrote the Omega Diet.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows every researcher anywhere in the world who's doing research on omega-3.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that, in essence, and this was one of the things that helped me connect the dots, she understood the importance of omega-3. But omega-3 is an anti-inflammatory, and I think that's its key. She said that her family had a farm in Crete, and so she went back to Crete with all of her knowledge and experience at NIH
mm-hmm.
and went to their farm, and, you know, they would free-range their chickens and their animals, mm-hmm. and the chickens don't eat grain if you free-range them. They eat bugs and plants, and they selectively go for purslane, which is a loaded in omega-3.
Mm-hmm.
She was able to take it back to NIH and analyze it. And so the true Mediterranean diet is, and the meat from the cows was much different because they would free range and eat the same stuff, and they would be, mm-hmm. instead of loaded with omega-6 from grains, they would be loaded with omega-3. And so the true Mediterranean diet is one where, number one, the animals are free ranged. They're, we call purslane a toxic weed in the United States, so we eliminate it, of course.
with chemical poisons.
Yeah, with chemical poisons. Isn't that brilliant? Okay. But elsewhere in the world, they let their animals eat it, and so they get loaded with omega-3.
Uh-huh.
And then the olive oil and then fish is of an important part of the Mediterranean diet, with the omega-3 and the anti-inflammatory effects. And then, of course, the fruits and the vegetables. And those are much more beneficial. Now, everyone likes to talk about wine, but in reality, the resveratrol is the benefit of red wine, which you can find from grape skins and grape juice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it doesn't have to be red wine to get the benefit. But that's the true Mediterranean diet. And when you have that anti-inflammatory effect, that's why they're going to have the reduced risk of all these chronic diseases.
Well, and that's something that people can learn to cook and learn to eat out. I mean, when you eat out, you can order that kind of diet as well.
Well,
I mean, at certain restaurants anyway, probably not at McDonald's, but... Yeah.
Well, but see, that's why I wanted to give basic guidelines, that even though I have almost 900 scientific references, it was written for the average person, so that the average person can say, what practically do I need to do, and even break it down into 25 simple steps. That's why I thought, if I can just, and any step in the right direction is going to reduce inflammation and reduce the risk of chronic disease, and it's not that tough.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We've been interviewing Dr. Duke Johnson on his book, The Optimal Health Revolution, and he truly has created a book here that is for anybody can appreciate and anybody can follow, simple steps as well as 900 references. I'm looking at them now. Yes, 900, almost 900 references. and you can also find more information in his website, and that's it's drdonjohnson.com. drdukejohnson.com.
Great.
Don Johnson is somebody on a TV show.
yeah, I'm different.
Yeah, you're different. You're not that guy.
No.
Well, thank you so much for getting up early. I assume you're in California. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm on the West Coast.
Okay. Exactly. Well, thank you for getting up a little early on your Saturday to join us on Temple of Health Radio Show. We do appreciate it.
And wonderful to be with you, Susan. I sure enjoyed being talking with you. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Next week we have Pam Montgomery, Plant Spirit Healing, A Guide to Working with Plant Consciousness. Dr. Clofine, who is my GYN doctor, will be interviewing her on that. And then the next week we have the Top 10 Lyme Disease Treatments, Defeat Lyme Disease with the Best of Conventional and Alternative Medicine. Lyme disease is something that is growing, at least here on the East Coast, and so it's good to know treatment options. We also have Noetic Science. Actually, we couldn't find anybody to give it this month, so I'm giving it. I'm giving it on the naked truth about breast implants, cell phones, GMO foods, and nanotechnology. Should be an interesting lecture. That's on the 17th of September at 7:30 at our Dunwoody office in 4370 Georgetown Square. Again, thank you very much for joining us, Temple of Health Radio Show, and thank you, Dr. Johnson. I enjoyed talking to you.
And you too. Thank you very much.
Don't you just hate trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute. You look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plastikos.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone skin and contour the body. Endermology by Plastikos feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plastikos, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plastikos at 770-457-4677. Plastikos Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.
join us every Saturday morning for Temple of Health Radio Show, brought to you by Plastikos and Millennium Healthcare. Our holistic medical practices in Atlanta are committed to community education. Our shows bring you national authors on topics of health alternatives, new scientific breakthroughs, and spiritual medicine.